I next met with Dr. Ola Landgren, who commented on the symposium module on relapse refractory myeloma. And to begin, he discussed his vision of the strategy of treatment of early relapse, which has changed since the ASH meeting in December 2014.
I think the treatment of early relapsed myeloma has changed dramatically the past 12 months. This is driven by the new studies that have delivered new striking results. They show that if you add a third drug, you can gain anything from 6 up to 18 or more months of remission-free time. My perspective on my clinical activity is very, very different today than it was, say, 10 years ago. The conversations I have with my patients in clinic focus much more about quality of life and things that people do on a daily basis. The therapies that we currently have, many of these therapies, you can actually be on these therapies and function. I have a lot of patients in my clinic that are professionals that work full time. I have a lot of active people that have retired, but they're still active. Today, before I came here to talk to you, Neil, I received an email from one of my patients who told me about all the things that she is doing with her husband. They're out riding motorbikes and they have friends coming over and they're very, very active. They travel. When I had clinic last week, I have a lot of patients that work full-time, professionals that have to spend many hours in their office, and they are still on therapy. And that's possible with these new drugs. So I think the old way of thinking about therapy was that if you had an active drug, it had to be toxic. But that's no longer true. So I think that it's a matter of picking active therapy or less active therapy, and it does not necessarily correlate with toxicity.
So with that sort of general, you know, background, I'm curious about what you're thinking about these newly approved agents. And let's start out with exazimib. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what it is and right now how you're thinking about its use.
Exazimib is the first oral proteasome inhibitor. So exazimib hits the same target as bortezomib and carfilzomib. They are 20S proteasome inhibitors. So it's really an oral form of bortezomib, if you want. Carfilzomib and bortezomib, they are chemically a little bit different from each other. Exazimib and bortezomib, they are very similar to each other on a chemical note. But all the three drugs, they hit the same target, the 20S proteasome. I think exazimib adds a lot to the myeloma field in that it is an oral strategy to hit that same target. You can add that drug to, for example, the backbone of lenalidomide and dexamethasone. That's a huge step forward for patients who, for various reasons, cannot receive a subcutaneous or an intravenous proteasome inhibitor. For them, up till the approval of exazimib, they were basically stuck with a two-drug combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, for example. I do think if you compare the data, and that has to be across studies with all the caveats that come with that, ideally you would have a head-to-head comparison in a randomized fashion, and that does at this time not exist. But if you do some kind of crude comparison across studies, I think it's fair to say that the subcutaneous administration of bortezomib seems to deliver a little bit more efficacy than exazimib. I do think that the IV administration of carfilzomib provides much deeper responses, also more durable responses if you compare across studies. Again, there is no randomized comparison in one single study, so that information is not yet available. I think bottom line, for the treatment of multiple myeloma, it's great to have many options. It's great for patients to have options to choose between. It's great for doctors to have many options to choose between. And it's true both for the newly diagnosed setting and if the disease were to come back at a later time, you could then swap and do the other one.
Before we get into where the monoclonal antibodies are fitting into your practice, just to, you know, finish out on proteasome inhibitors, we asked a bunch of poll questions to the audience using the iPads. And one relevant to the topic you just brought up, namely proteasome inhibitors and carfilzomib, we asked them, do they do cardiac screening prior to administering carfilzomib? And actually, most of the audience said yes, although I don't know. What was your answer to that question?
My answer to the question is the same answer that I would give to my fellows in clinic if they ask me every week what to do. And that answer is, if the patient does not have an underlying cardiovascular disorder, there is no need to do additional workup for that patient before you give carfilzomib. If the patient has an underlying cardiovascular disorder, I would always do an echo of the heart, or I would at least consider that. In neither of the two situations would I do NT-proBNP blood testing. The reason I wouldn't do that is because if you are going to give a drug like carfilzomib, also you will give it together with fluid, you would see an increase in the NT-proBNP after you have given the drug. So once you collect that information, now what are you going to do with it? You have to act upon that. But in my clinical experience, I've treated very many patients, more than 100 patients with this drug. There is no clinical correlation between that number going up and the clinical outcome in terms of worsening of any of these symptoms. So my answer would be, if there is no underlying cardiovascular disease, I would not do an echo.
We talked about what's known right now about carfilzomib and the heart and referred back to some data that been presented actually from the ASPIRE trial that you were mentioning before. But at this point, what exactly do we know about the effects of carfilzomib in the heart? And you mentioned looking for pre-existing cardiac disease. Do we know to what extent hydration has anything to do with this?
So currently what's known is that if you give carfilzomib with too much fluid, you will run the risk of causing congestive heart failure in a proportion of patients. We also know if you scale back on the fluids, you will see much less of that. In addition, we know that there is a very small proportion of patients that have some development of congestive heart failure, maybe 1% or so. The number is round. I don't have access to all patients that have been treated, so I cannot give a more precise number than that. But in my experience, it's somewhere around 1% or so. The underlying mechanism for that are not known. In addition to the cardiovascular component, also there is a small proportion of patients, maybe 5% or so. I'm not sure, again, about the exact number. But a small proportion of patients have a rapid onset of shortness of breath. And it usually happens a few days after the first few infusions, let's say day 5 or 4 or 6 or something like that. And it lasts for some hours and then it goes away. And in my experience, in most patients, it never comes back again. I have spent a lot of time trying to investigate those individuals who have developed these symptoms. We have done a lot of research with imaging and biomarkers, and we have never been able to explain what's going on. To my knowledge, the company that owns the drug have also done a lot of work, and they have consistently said that they do not understand the pathophysiology. For none of the patients where we have observed shortness of breath, have we seen any residual symptoms or any detectable, quantifiable damage in any organs that have been involved. So there is some mechanism that we don't understand that relates to this shortness of breath. And it's a small proportion of patients, less than 5% in my experience.
Can you just, again, just more from a global perspective, talk about what you're thinking about right now in terms of elotuzumab and daratumumab? And maybe as a preface, you can go through what we know about those two agents.
Both elotuzumab and daratumumab were approved in November of 2015. That's the same month as ixazomib was approved. Daratumumab was the first monoclonal antibody to be approved for the indication of multiple myeloma, and it's after 3 prior lines of therapy. It targets CD38, which is known to be expressed on the surface of virtually every myeloma cell. It's given as an infusion, and the dosing schedule is that it's once a week in the beginning, then it's every other week, and then eventually it becomes monthly or every other month. Daratumumab, similar to most drugs, was initially developed as a single agent drug, showing around 30-35% response rate overall. That was information presented at ASH 2015 showing that if you add lenalidomide and dexamethasone to daratumumab, that you bring up overall response rate even further. You have deeper responses. This has been presented at prior meetings as well.
Can you talk a little bit about how you conceptualize the mechanisms of action of these two monoclonal antibodies? Because it seems quite different.
So there are multiple parallel mechanisms of action. So you have the ADCC, you have the CDC, the complement derived, you have the cytotoxic cellular derived killing, the first ADCC, and you have the CTC, which is the complement derived cytotoxicity. And then also you could have a direct killing where you cause apoptosis by binding. So what these three mechanisms really mean is that you could activate immune cells, you could activate the complement, or you could kill directly. That has been found to be the case for daratumumab. The company has also observed in their studies that there are other cell types that are being altered in the body of people that have received the drug. More specifically so, they have seen that there are changes in both B and T cells, and they have seen that these subsets of cells become more and they become more active. So there is speculation that maybe the drug could lead to activation and proliferation of subsets of cells that potentially could kill the myeloma cells. To my knowledge, there is no scientific evidence that these cell activations and proliferations truly are the killers of the myeloma cells. It is possible that these cells, they actually are, but it's also possible that they are parallel phenomena of what's going on when the drug causes the first three mechanisms that I mentioned. If it turns out that the activation and proliferation of the B and T cells truly do occur when this drug is used, that could open up avenues for this drug to be given to patients who do not express CD38. But again, the scientific evidence for that mechanism actually have a cell-killing activity that is currently missing. And I'm sure there will be research done in the coming 12 to 24 months looking into this, because this is a potentially very, very hot topic.
So elotuzumab is approved and has been studied combined with lenalidomide. Can you describe a clinical situation or a typical clinical situation where you would use it or have used it?
Elotuzumab is the second monoclonal antibody. It targets SLAMF7, which also is expressed on the surface of myeloma cells. The drug was initially developed and evaluated as a single drug, and it did not have any efficacy. So the subsequent trial designs were based on lenalidomide, dexamethasone with the drug versus without the drug, elotuzumab. And they showed that with the addition of elotuzumab, there was a 30% better progression-free survival, or hazard ratio was 0.7. That drug has a lot of strength compared to the other monoclonal antibody we just talked about, daratumumab. One of them being that elotuzumab is a much shorter infusion. It's about an hour. Weaknesses are that the single drug administration of that drug does not lead to any clinical benefit. Also, if you compare between studies, and you cannot draw any conclusions from any randomized studies comparing them head to head because they have not yet been done. But if you compare across studies, it seems that the daratumumab effect is more profound. We don't have randomized studies comparing them within the same study. From my perspective, I think elotuzumab is a little bit less effective drug, but it seems to be much more convenient given that you can give much shorter infusions. Also, it's only every third week, while daratumumab in the beginning is given weekly. So I think it's the same trade-off as we discussed when we talked about proteasome inhibitors. You have the balance between efficacy and you have convenience. You don't have as much of the toxicity issues when it comes to monoclonal antibodies, but there is a little bit of that. I think it's mostly a trade-off between efficacy and convenience when it comes to monoclonal antibodies.
For practical purposes, could you describe a clinical situation where you would use elotuzumab / lenalidomide?
A typical situation I would consider elotuzumab in my practice is a patient who, for example, has been treated with combination therapy with or without high-dose malphalan-rich stem cells, who is now on maintenance therapy with lenalidomide 10 milligrams. And that has been going on for a while. Now you start seeing a biochemical relapse. You're thinking about maybe you need to start therapy. I think that type of scenario is a pretty good scenario to consider elotuzumab, and then you increase your lenalidomide dose to 25 milligrams, and then you go back with your steroids with dexamethasone. You could also argue that in such a situation that you could use daratumumab. You could also argue that you should use a three-drug combination with the proteasome inhibitors. And no one knows which is the ultimate way of using these drugs. It comes back to what you brought up before, Neil, the sequential approach versus the stringed out approach. You could argue that if you go in with the strongest drugs in this first relapse, that you could maximize the benefit. I guess you could also argue that if you use a more gentle approach, you still have the other more powerful approaches for later if you need them. But we don't have the ultimate answer, which is the best way of doing it in terms of how can you maximize overall survival. That we don't know.
What about initial relapse of a patient who's not on lenalidomide maintenance? It seems like it's pretty common, particularly with the use of indefinite maintenance for patients to have their first relapse, as you just described, while on maintenance lenalidomide. But what about patients who, for example, haven't gotten maintenance therapy, or patients who are on bortezomib? How do you think through various options, particularly the monoclonal antibodies in those patients?
I think you, in my opinion, have very similar options. You could consider starting combinations with lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and elotuzumab if there was a relapse, even if the patient was not on maintenance. So I think if you monitor the patient on or not on maintenance, you may see your patient every 3 months with some blood test. If you start seeing a monoclonal protein coming back or light chains starting to come back, you have a biochemical relapse, you could consider using the same drugs. It depends very much, I think, on the rapidity of the changes. If the M spike goes from not detectable to, let's say, 0.7 and then 1.8 and then 3.1 in a very short period of time, then I would not take that approach. I would use a much more powerful approach. But if you have a small M spike that shows up, let's say with immunofixation, and it's 0.2 and it's 0.4 and it's 0.5 and it keeps on going up slowly, you have very many options to choose between. And I think in that setting, this is a very reasonable approach.
What do we know right now? What's your clinical experience in terms of infusion reactions to the two monoclonal antibodies and any other tolerability issues?
I think elotuzumab, from my experience and from the literature, seems to be a very tolerable drug. It's relatively short infusions, about an hour, very limited reactions for the most part. If you have infusion reactions, it usually would refer to the first infusion, but quite limited. When it comes to daratumumab, the infusion reactions almost always occur the first infusion, similar to the elotuzumab drug. They are much more profound. It impacts the infusion rate. So in clinical reality, it is not uncommon that the patient needs to spend 10 hours in clinic to get that first infusion. And that's a big, big problem clinically on a practical note. There is ongoing work right now to see whether you can use some pre-medication. Can you maybe do steroids the day before? Maybe the dose can be a little bit different. This is work that's ongoing. Maybe there could be other approaches as well. But for right now, the way the drug is approved, I think the first dose is a little bit of a barrier. Now, beyond that first infusion, it seems to be extremely well tolerable and the benefits are fantastic. So I would strongly encourage the use of the drug, But one has to be aware that the first infusion can be a little bit of a challenge, in particular when it comes to the duration, and also you have to deal with the side effects. And typically, in my experience with daratumumab, they are infusion reactions related to breathing. So you can have shortness of breath or a drop in your saturation, oxygen saturation. The patient can feel in the mouth that it's swelling. The tongue is swelling, the lips can be swelling.
So, you know, November 2015 was certainly a memorable month for myeloma in terms of three agents being approved, as you mentioned. But earlier in the year, there was another agent approved, the HDAC inhibitor, panobinostat. And we talked about that also at the meeting and with all these other things going on and where that fits in combination with bortezomib. Again, can you talk about what we know about how the drug works and the clinical efficacy and where, if at all, you're integrating it into your practice?
So panobinostat belongs, as you just mentioned, to the group of drugs called HDAC inhibitors. It's a pan-HDAC inhibitor. Scientifically, when you block the proteasome, the cell can no longer get rid of misfolded proteins through the proteasome. That's been blocked by, for example, bortezomib, cofilsimib, or ixazomib. So what the cell is doing then, it's trying to get rid of them through forming agrosomes that can go into the lysosomes and then tear these proteins apart. So that's a parallel function that the cells use to escape from the inhibition of the proteasome. So it makes very good sense to try to combine an HDAC inhibitor with a proteasome inhibitor. Now, the work that has been done along the lines of HDAC inhibitors using bortezomib and dexamethasone as the backbone does not really show that that is very, very powerful. We had one experience several years ago now when the first HDAC inhibitor was developed, and it was significantly different, but it added only a couple of weeks of longer progression-free survival. So it was not approved by the FDA. When the second HDAC inhibitor was developed, that's the one we are talking about, panobinostat, the benefit was longer, but again, the results were not striking. And I think in particular, they were not striking because the toxicities were quite profound. There were a lot of grade 3 diarrhea. And also HDAC inhibitors are known to impact the bone marrow, so you have drops in the counts. But I think in particular, the inconvenience with the diarrhea was what people were concerned about. The drug was reviewed and approved by the FDA, so it is available. I do still think that the drug has efficacy. The studies that have been done after the approval by the FDA indicate that if you bundle the drug with other drugs than bortezomib, you actually have much less toxicity. So similar to what has been found in drug development in many other areas in the cancer drug development field is that if you bundle your drug with the wrong partner, you could end up with a lot of trouble, and then you may have to go back and then you could partner with another drug. There is data showing if you combine it with cofilsimib, it seems to be much more tolerable. You can also combine it with lenalidomide or other drugs as well. Also, the question is whether the dose was not right, if it was too high of a dose, maybe too frequent. There is also work ongoing showing that if you give it a little bit less often at lower doses, that that would take the edge of the diarrhea. I think overall, given the very tight competition with all the new monoclonal antibodies, having access to an oral proteasome inhibitors and the drugs that we already have, I think cofilsimib is a great drug, lenalidomide is a great drug, we have pomalidomide. We have a lot of options. Having a drug that is surrounded by toxicity, that makes that drug less attractive if you have other options. And that's of course true in any given situation for any disease. But we have to remember that unfortunately there is no established cure for this disease. So many patients unfortunately in the end may run out of options. And it's good to have options when you run out of the ones that you have already tried. So I do think that the drug has a role. It's for later relapses.
Let's talk a little bit about smoldering myeloma. Could you kind of provide an update of what we've learned in the last couple of years about the natural history of the disease and in terms of the potential for initiation of therapy?
I think from all we know when it comes to early detection of disease, I think we are almost at a juncture when it's time to start thinking about completely new terminology. As you know, I have done a lot of work on the topic of monoclonal gammopathy, undetermined significance, MGUS. I've done a lot of work for smoldering myeloma and a lot of other people around the world that have been interested in it. I do think it's time to think about new terminology. And what I'm thinking here is that having a monoclonal gammopathy, where we could basically leave people pretty much alone and not continue to monitor them and harass and do a lot of unnecessary testing. And I think for patients who have a little bit more presence of disease, that would be more of an early myeloma. So that indicates that I'm thinking that we should focus more on the people who are on the trajectory of developing the disease. When we look in patients who are in the smoldering category, if you genetically profile these patients, you cannot see a difference compared to the multiple myeloma genetics. They look identically the same if you use high-resolution sequencing. It's more a matter of the burden of disease. And if you follow them over time, if you pick the right patients, it's more a matter of time until they do develop kidney failure or fractures. So my projection is that in the very near future, I think that we are going to change the paradigm from watch and wait to do more early intervention. And this is going to be facilitated by access to better drugs that are much less toxic and also better monitoring. So it comes back to this whole business of molecular monitoring, the MRD monitoring, and the newer drugs. That's what I think.
What about the actual criteria to make the diagnosis? Have there been changes in that over the last few years?
In November 2014, the updated International Myeloma Working Group criteria came out. And in addition to the very old CRAB criteria, that actually originates back to at least the 1980s, if you look in the first case report that Bob Kyle published on this topic with smoldering myeloma. So in addition to those CRAB criteria, there were three more factors that were added. The first one was 60% or more plasma cell infiltration of the bone marrow. That came out of observations from Mayo Clinic, very small number of patients, and there were some attempts trying to replicate that in the Greek group in collaboration with Mayo. That was added. The second one was having a very skewed light chain ratio. So if the one that's increased, the involved light chain divided by the uninvolved, if that ratio is greater than 100, and the one that is elevated is more than 10 milligrams per deciliter. And the unit is important. Some labs, they do milligrams per liter. Some do milligrams per deciliter. So it should be 10 milligrams per deciliter. Those patients should also be called multiple myeloma. So that was one of the three added new variables. And the third one was having evidence of focal processes or lesions in the bone marrow or in the bone detectable by MRI. The second one was also identified by Mayo Clinic, and they also work with the Greek to try to replicate that. And the third one with the MRI was done by the group in Heidelberg led by Jens Hillengass. He did whole body MRI, and they have an excellent imaging program there in Germany. The Greek group also tried to replicate that, and using spine and pelvis MRI, they found that around 95% of those changes that you could pick up with a whole body MRI, you can pick up in the spine and the pelvis. So the guidelines say check for the bone marrow if you have more than 60% plasma cells, check in the blood if the light chain ratio is more than 100 and the involved is more than 10 milligrams per deciliter. Check with an MRI. If you have a whole body, then you should do that. Else you should do the spine and the pelvis. And if you see two or more focal areas, if one or more of those, with or without presence of CRAB criteria, the patient has multiple myeloma requiring therapy.
Once the patient sort of, enters that diagnostic category, Do you then apply your usual algorithm for upfront therapy, or are you not as aggressive because, I don't know, you're kind of diagnosing it earlier?
So the guidelines say that we are moving away from symptoms setting the diagnosis to biomarker setting the diagnosis. So the guidelines say that there is no longer what's called asymptomatic myeloma, which used to be a synonym for smoldering myeloma. You could be asymptomatic and still have multiple myeloma by the new criteria. So the guidelines say we now have multiple myeloma requiring therapy. That should be the correct terminology. So once you set the diagnosis, you should apply the modern treatment algorithm. So I would start 3-drug combination therapy, and that's what all my colleagues around the world that I work with would do as well.
And, you know, without getting into the whole discussion about selection of therapy, but in terms of myeloma specifically, and, you know, I guess early myeloma or the smoldering kind of cases that you diagnose as myeloma, you've looked at the CRD regimen as well as obviously in the larger series, but what specifically have you seen?
Are we talking about the application of these drugs in the setting of
smoldering disease?
So we developed, when I used to work at the NIH, a 3-drug combination, and we built it on the backbone of lenalidomide and dexamethasone, which was published in the New England Journal by Maria Mateos and co-authors. In their study, they used lenalidomide dexamethasone in 60 patients for 9 cycles, followed by 2 years of maintenance lenalidomide, compared to 60 patients that were followed without any therapy. They were all high-risk smoldering myeloma. They showed progression-free and they showed an overall survival benefit. In their study, after completion of the 9 cycles, they had 14%, 1-4, complete response rate. So building on that, we added cofilsimib and we gave 8 cycles of combination therapy. After the completion of therapy, we put patients on 2 years also on lenalidomide maintenance. We found 100% complete response rate. When we looked in the first series that we treated with 12 patients, 11 out of those 12 were MRD 10 to minus 5 negative, and 10 out of the 12 were an MRD 10 to minus 6 negative. At 3 years of follow-up, none of those patients have progressed to multiple myeloma. It's a very small study. I transitioned from the NIH to Memorial Sloan Kettering at the time when this study was completed, and there was a plan to expand the study, but because of my transition, things got delayed. We are now working on a new study where we are planning on randomizing between these two regimens I was mentioning in a randomized head-to-head comparison to fully nail down the progression-free survival difference, if there is one. That's the hypothesis of the study. And we will also look into MRD negativity status.
So let's touch a little bit on AL amyloidosis. We had a case that was presented by Dr. Morgenstein. Can you talk about where we are today with the treatment of AL amyloidosis?
Because AL amyloidosis is a rare condition, unfortunately, at this time, there is no randomized study to guide what therapy is the best therapy to use. We have information from single-arm studies suggesting that the use of CyBorD, cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone is a very powerful therapy, and it's tolerable. All those drugs you can give even if the patient has involvement of the kidney. They are not dependent on a completely healthy kidney. So I think that would be a good option to use a 3-drug combination with a proteasome inhibitor and cyclophosphamide and dexamethasone. The problem with the disease is that the deposition of these proteins does not go away if you kill off the cells that release the proteins. So for a long time, people have been thinking about, is there a way to get rid of the proteins that have been deposited? There was a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine very recently looking into the application of monoclonal antibody that can go after those deposited proteins, as well as after those proteins that are also still circulating in the bloodstream. They have used imaging and they have also used biomarkers to try to get at evaluation of the drug. And what they show is that it seems to clear up affected organs, and specifically they have looked into the liver. There are ongoing trials, and we are participating in one of these trials using combination therapy with such monoclonal antibodies. I think this is extremely intriguing. I think treating patients earlier and using these types of strategies probably could significantly improve outcome in this disease.
Let's finish out talking about Waldenstrom macroglobulinemia. Can you talk about sort of what's new there and anything came out at ASH of any great note?
So are you referring to drugs? I don't think there were any new drugs. I mean, it's the ibrutinib and then the monoclonal antibodies and then the molecular testing. Is there anything particular you want me to talk about?
No, actually, I was thinking maybe, you know, Dr. Morgenstein presented a really tough case of WM, 61-year-old man who initially went on a trial of everolimus, no benefit, then got VRD, good response, placed on maintenance R, then had disease progression in about a year, started on ibrutinib, but developed severe atrial fibrillation and actually really didn't even benefit by ibrutinib very much. Tried carfilzomib with not much response. Any comments about this case history and how typical or atypical it is and any other options a patient like that might have?
I think the use of a proteasome inhibitor in Waldenstrom macroglobulinemia in combination with Rituxan would be my preference, also in combination with steroid. That would be my probably to go to therapy. This patient had recurrence and received ibrutinib. That is also molecularly very rational approach going after this disease. In this particular patient, you mentioned that the drugs, they didn't work, and they also called cardiac problems. I think in my experience, these drugs usually do work. So I don't think this patient is representative of the bulk of patients that I have seen and treated with these drugs. Unfortunately, there are always patients that stand out from the average, and this patient, unfortunately, is one of them. This patient had received 3 lines of therapy. I think for a patient who received so many lines of therapy in a disease where the therapy is not clear, which is the best therapy, I think such a patient should be offered access to a clinical trial. And that would be my answer. I think it's important for patients who have a rare disease to be offered to go to a specialist clinic and see what's available, instead of just trying drugs locally. I think going there, seeing what's available, if there is a new clinical trial, and have a discussion. It may be that the patient decides to go back to be treated by the local physician, but at least give the patient the option to see a specialist clinic where the newest drugs are available for such a rare disease.
Any trial concepts out there right now, trials that you're putting patients on, new agents in WM?
So the drugs that I'm interested in would include ibrutinib, and I also think the backbone of carfilzomib, I think it's important. At this time, I do not have a new trial open for Waldenstrom, but those are drugs that I think are very powerful. There are other molecular targets that do make sense, CXCR4, one of them, plerixafor. I have currently no trial developed for that particular mechanism of action. And there are other rational approaches as well, but I do not have any trials for right now.
Any data on exazimib in Waldenstrom's?
I am actually not sure. Did they present that at the meeting?
I don't think so, no.
Well, so I could say, I think from all we know, the proteasome inhibition seems to work extremely well in Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia. Bortezomib has been used in several studies. The CARD therapy that Steve Treon developed was based on carfilzomib. I am personally not aware of available exazimib data, but I do think that that would be a very reasonable drug to combine with other drugs, given that it's an oral form that would make it very convenient. And I think it could also be a very good maintenance drug for these patients. And that's true also for many myeloma patients that are looking for maintenance therapy.